And
on the line, I've got Barry Zwicker. Barry is a veteran Canadian journalist. He was the first in the world to deeply question the official story on 9/11 and on national TV. And he's also the director of the six-day International Citizens Inquiry into 9/11 at the University of Toronto. His new book, Towers of Deception, The Media Cover-Up of 9/11, has just been released by New Society Publishers. Barry Zwicker, welcome.
Oh, it's good to be here, Alan.
All right, thanks. I really appreciate you sending me the book to read. It was really a great read. And I think it's a really important book, too, because it calls into question the media's role in the 9/11 cover-up and why people believe the way they do about 9/11. And I'm interested, just to start off, is what motivated you to write this book?
Right. My motivation flows to some extent out of my life experience. I've been a journalist in journalism and communications all my life, since the age of 15. Almost all that time, I've also been an activist, which is a little unusual for a journalist. Even though I was in mainstream journalism, I was part of the peace movement, anti-Vietnam War movement, and then later the environmental movement. And my employers knew that, and I managed to get away with it because my journalism was pretty careful. I'm actually a fraidy cat. I'm scared shitless that I'll make a mistake, which is a very good characteristic to have, because it helps you to be more accurate than some other people who are arrogant and egotistical and don't check their facts.
Right.
So I developed the habit of checking my facts. And I became, however, as you can imagine, a critic of the media even while working in it, because I had this whole other worldview which grew out of my activism in the peace movement and the environmental movement. And finally, I had to leave mainstream journalism because it was... and became a media critic. So that was about 1970. And so it's natural that a book such as this, Towers of Deception, the media cover-up of 9/11, would come from someone with such a long track record in criticizing the media, with a knowledge of the media from the inside and the outside. But this particular book, I saw that no one else was apparently tackling this particular intersection. And I know that so many people are so concerned about the media, and yet no one was tackling this intersection. I thought, well, it's kind of my duty, it's my enthusiasm, it's my necessity to tackle it. But when I did, I knew also that I had to deal with psychology,
right,
deal with the human phenomenon of denial. I also knew I had to deal with the invisible government that controls so much, really creates this vast illusion, this synthetic environment within which we live, and also that I had to tackle the central device by which this oligarchy tricks the populace and mobilizes it to their agenda, which is, in a word, false flag operations,
right,
fake events. So I had to pull all those things in, and the result was this book.
Well, it's really well done. In the first chapter, you start with an essay that you wrote for the Toronto Star about a year ago. Right now,
almost exactly a year ago,
and then you include in your book the entire article, and then at the end it says it wasn't published, and this was a very left leaning magazine in a rather left leaning country, and it was just kind of an interesting. Examination into, you know, and you sort of go into this guy, this editor is a person that you've worked with for years and know personally, and it's kind of interesting what his excuses were, and that he acknowledged in the email he said to you that there is some support for a let it happen on purpose theory, but he doesn't support the made it happen on purpose theory. But even if it was a let it happen on purpose, then that would be grounds for impeachment and huge news.
That's quite right. And just as I'm responding to you, I have to mention a technical thing. Your voice was becoming fainter and fainter and fainter, and I can barely hear you. So if there's anything you can do technically to raise up your own voice for me, that's going to be helpful.
Will do.
There you go. I hear you now. The first chapter is a detailed case history of specifically how 9/11, well-evidenced, well-founded questions about 9/11 are effectively censored out of the media, just as if it was Pravda.
Mm-hmm.
That's what chapter one is.
And then chapter two, you get into the actual evidence of 9/11. You go the evidence from A to Z. You give 26 specific examples of where the official story is either omitted completely, or lied about, or ignored, or maybe we can just for evidentiary purposes, we can go into a few of the pieces of evidence to support at least reinvestigating, if not 9/11.
Well, yes. Now, actually, in Chapter 2, mm-hmm. Called 9/11 is a Number, Here Are the Facts, Evidence Proves White House Complicity, it isn't so much that I'm dealing with media malfeasance here or mm-hmm. censorship. This chapter is an attempt to lay out, and there's something like 12,000 words of footnotes here, to lay out these exhibits A to Z, as you say, with Exhibit A, in every sense of the word, being the collapse of World Trade Center Building Number 7.
Yeah.
And this is to try to provide, I wouldn't say an unanswerable series of facts,
mm-hmm.
but they're just as well-founded as I can possibly make them. There's hundreds of footnotes. And so if a person who happens to get this book and is still a little fuzzy that
right.
could they really have done it, it's a stretch, somebody would have blown the whistle,
mm-hmm.
it was just incompetence, there are a whole lot of rationalizations people have. This gives to the serious reader a lot of facts that standard operating procedures
mm-hmm.
were not followed by NORAD on 9/11, that's Exhibit B. The fighter jets, the particular Otis Air Force Base fighter jets, were put into a delaying pattern. That's Exhibit C. Exhibit D is the Langley fighter jets that were ordered out over the Atlantic to go entirely the wrong direction. No wonder not a single U.S. jet interceptor turned a
yeah.
wheel until it was too late on 9/11 in a drama in the skies that lasted almost 2 hours. And then Exhibit E is the fighters at Andrews Air Force Base. And so on. Exhibit G is the war games that helped to paralyze
right.
the U.S. Air Force. That's it goes on.
And in fact,
I think that that this is the key thing you'll find for people who are, I call them, the apologist community.
Right.
The apologist community. A hallmark of these people. And I don't want to speak disparagingly of other human beings. I hope there's no tone in my voice that
mm-hmm.
that I'm dismissive or disrespectful of people who disagree with me. But people I've met and encountered as recently as yesterday, really nice people, intelligent people, the key thing that enables them to continue to believe the official story is that they simply have not looked at the evidence.
Yep.
They are too busy, or they've had other things to do, or they don't have the motivation. That whatever it is, the
mm-hmm.
fact is they haven't looked at the evidence. And then, of course, it gets worse with people like Noam Chomsky who refuse,
right.
consistently refuse to look at the evidence well after they've had an opportunity to, and when everything points to the fact that they should, judging by their track record in other areas of politics and human affairs.
So, or they feel like they don't have to look at the evidence themselves because the 9/11 Commission did all that. And they issued a report, and they still trust their government and what they've been told, and everyone around them says it. So why should I go into all the gruesome details?
Well, that's interesting, because now people have lost that. I heard that a lot. But
mm-hmm.
now the 9/11 Commission is saying NORAD lied to us.
Yeah.
That's Kane and Hamilton. So actually that old, the 9/11 Commission looked into it. They solved it. That's good enough for me. Now, that's been lost now.
Right. Well, you know, what's funny is because this morning I was listening to the Rachel Maddow show on Air America, and she had on Governor Keene of the 9/11 Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And she asked Exhibit R in your book, which is the 9/11 Commission that was delayed and obstructed for 441 days. 441 days. And she asked Governor Keene why. And he said that he thought it was fear of political reprisals, and it was an election year, and the Bush administration was kind of afraid of political fallout. And which I thought was a weak excuse, but what do you expect from Governor Keene? But
well, actually, Alan, it's ludicrous, because mm-hmm. if America was the innocent victim mm-hmm. of a fanatical attack by crazy Muslims, wouldn't looking into it and getting more facts about them and actually enough facts to bring them to trial and so on,
yeah.
wouldn't that be a big boost for the Bush administration?
Yeah. No, absolutely.
It's not only a weak argument, it's actually contradictory.
Yeah. Then also, beyond examining the evidence that you have for this, then you say, well, where's the evidence that supports the official story? And because there isn't a whole lot, really, when it comes right down to it. NATO, there was some story about in your book about NATO and how they have the information, but they're not going to get public with it or something to that effect.
Yes, well, the NATO invoked Clause 5. Of its charter, which it had never invoked before. That's the clause that if one country is attacked, it shall be considered an attack on all the countries of NATO. And they did that on the basis of closed-door testimony that the American representative allegedly gave to prove that bin Laden and al-Qaeda were behind 9/11.
Right.
But to this minute that we are speaking, that proof has never been made public by the NATO Council, by the United States of America,
mm-hmm.
Or by any of the NATO countries.
Wow.
It just hasn't been done. And so the basis of American troops going to Afghanistan, and now there's 1,500 Canadian troops in Afghanistan, it's a non-existent basis. It's actually an illegal invasion of Afghanistan.
Yeah.
We'll, you know, leave Iraq out of it for the moment. This is just one of the many huge holes in the official unfolding of history as it's presented to us by the establishment and by the establishment media. And it's so gargantuanly off base that most people can't imagine that it is. It's like the Truman Show, mm-hmm. writ large.
Well, that makes me sort of go into a little bit of the psychology of 9/11 Ken Jenkins has spoken eloquently on the psychological aspects of this, as well as other people, and it clearly is a psyop or a psychological operation on the American people and on the world, really, to instill fear and to stop thinking, really, to just stop thought and move into instinctive fear-based understanding. And I'm kind of interested I'm interested in your take on the difference between knowing and believing, especially when it comes to journalists.
Yes, before I respond, Alan, again, your voice is so weak. I'm having to really strain to hear you.
I know that it's going out fine on the thing because I've got my mic up. And the sound is better through my mic.
It's when I talk into the phone, it doesn't sound as good.
All right. But like right now, when you just said that, I'm hearing you a whole
right.
lot better.
Okay.
So you'll just have to split the diff there.
Okay.
My son's in audio post-production. I know the problems with sound.
Okay.
And I just want to remind you that at times your voice is so light that it's really a strain for me to catch what you're saying. But the psychology, now, and I'm glad you mentioned Ken Jenkins, because Ken and I are great friends, and we have dialogues about all sorts of stuff. And he has been one of the earliest ones to send me a very friendly criticism about Chapter 3, which is about denial and psychology. It's titled 9/11 Truth is Hidden in Plain Sight, 2001 Tricks for Avoiding the Obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Ken has, this is what I was looking for on my on my email when before the program started is to look for the exchange that Ken and I had. And I think he made a very valid point. He said he was he likes the book, but he said he was disappointed that there's not enough attention to, he was talking actually about Chapter 5, about the shame of Noam Chomsky mm-hmm. and the left gatekeepers. But so I have to correct myself. He was talking about Chapter 5. And he said he was disappointed that there wasn't enough attention paid to the fact that people in the left media and in left organizations are perfectly capable of being blindsided by denial, by fear, mm-hmm. by the usual rationalizations to which us human beings can fall victim to. And I think he was right in that criticism. I told him, I said, it's unfortunate. I didn't mean to leave the impression that people on the left are not human beings who have the usual failings that we all have, where we tend to accept the first story we hear, and then our left brain rationalizes to back that story up, even if it's obviously baloney,
right.
Steven Pinker calls. And also, we figured out a way, and Ken has already agreed with me today in an email. I said it would be so easy for me to fix that chapter, because all I would have to do, and I think I'll do it if there's a second edition, I will do it if there's a second edition, is to say that all the typical pitfalls of us human beings to rationalize and deny apply to these people in the left media.
Yeah.
And they are fully explored in Chapter 3. Mm-hmm. That's all I had to say.
Right.
but it's a good point.
Well, and it's interesting too, because you break down the what happens on the inside of a person when these horrific things happen. It infantilizes the American consciousness, so that we then need the daddy figure of Bush and whoever to tell us that, oh, these bad people are out there and we're going to keep you safe, and don't worry, little child, you'll be fine. Your daddy's here. And
yes.
It's really important. It's to know, to see that, and get some perspective on that process.
Well, I think so. I myself have been very. I don't know why. My mother had problems with depression, and she had a lot of psychosomatic illness. I mean, I loved her dearly, but as a child, I became aware on some level of my mother's difficulties, and perhaps that what led me to become interested in psychology. And I remember around the age of 12, in the newspaper, there was just a single, it was on the comic page of all places, a single panel called Mirror of Your Mind. It was quite well done. They packed quite a message into each one of those panels. I remember reading those as a kid. And, of course, in university, I went to I took psychology, was very interested in it, and I followed it ever since. Subscribed to Psychology Today for a long time, but it's become a really downstream thing. There's nothing much in it anymore.
Yeah.
But as a social activist all my life, I've kept running into all these excuses that people trot out to poo-poo that we're in danger from nuclear proliferation, to poo-poo that there's anything called global warming and everything. So I've been up against this in a very practical way all my life,
right.
Where people find all these excuses for not looking at things, not believing of things, looking at them but looking away, saying, well, you're right, but I'm not going to do anything about it,
right.
You know, which ultimately you hope that people will see things that are very important to the lives of themselves, their children, and the planet, and furthermore, they will decide to do something about it, because if we don't get enough people who do something about it, we're really cooked. And fortunately, more and more and more people are concerned about these things, and increasing numbers of them are doing something about it. But this week, I'm so glad I have Chapter 3, which delves into the psychology. And when I was researching that chapter, I found that things were even worse than I had thought, even after a lifetime of studying this on and off. And what really was alarming was some new information. I'm not sure whether I can find it here in the book as we're speaking, but you might recall, if you as you did read the book, that that when we just us humans, this is something that's common to us all. This is now now proven to my satisfaction by neurophysiological research on the brain. We now have so many ways to read what the brain is doing. We can look at the electrical activity. We can look at the blood flow. We can look at the temperature.
Right.
And we have MRIs and fMRIs and CAT scans and PET scans. And this, to me, has replaced philosophy as a major incision point into reality. And what has been found lately is that when people were wired up and they were presented with information that they didn't like, that was contrary to their existing worldview, when they rejected that information, even though they knew that that information was valid,
mm-hmm.
when they just rejected it, that's rather perverse that we would do that, and I'm afraid to one extent or another, all of us do it from time to time, and some of us do it all the time. But the really, really frightening thing is that as people reject information they simply don't like, the pleasure centers of their brains light up.
Yeah.
And the cognitive part, the rational part of the brain, is almost dead. So we are not rational beings, and I think that in any important subject, we have to pay attention to that and take it into account as best we can.
Yeah, I just actually looked up the link that you provided for that story in the index. I looked it up. It was on NewYorkTimes.com, and I gave it because I engage in online discussions with people, and one of these guys just loves just to discount me automatically. So I said, well, you know, I'm not going to enable. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I guess we're getting a call in on the other line. My call waiting is beeping, but and you know, so I gave him a link, and I was like, I'm not going to be your enabler anymore, you know. So just, you know, just suffice to say that 9/11 was an inside job, and I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to be your cocaine fix anymore, you know.
Yeah.
That is really amazing, and I think that really is what fuels a lot of people's active resistance, is they get a charge out of being a professional debunker. Being someone who, you know, likes to, you know, call BS on things, like that Penn and Teller guys, you know, on their TV show, that they got a show called Bullshit, you know, and that's their.
Yep.
So I'd like to just jump ahead to another chapter on Chomsky. At the very beginning, there's a quote that you gave of his that says that he said to you, to your face, look, this is just a conspiracy theory.
That's right.
And then I'd like you to tell us a little bit about that encounter. But first, I want to give this other quote to back it up. This is Chomsky's quote. He says, conspiracy theories has become a four-letter word. It's something that people say when they don't want you to think about what's really going on. And then for him to say, look, this is just a conspiracy theory, when you asked him, I guess, directly about 9/11?
I did.
It's kind of
no. It's remarkable, and I think that I'm very I'm providing a pretty decent service in articulating this and detailing it, revealing it, and discussing it.
Mm-hmm.
I've interviewed Noam Chomsky three times for television. I had my own television show. I was on Canadian TV for 15 years on a particular channel, Vision TV, and so then I got my own show. And I did three segments, I should say. I did five segments on Chomsky, which arose from three interviews in different years. And the last time I interviewed him was in November of 2002.
Wow.
And this was in Hamilton, Ontario. He had come to give the Bertrand Russell Memorial Lecture. And by the way, just an aside here, I hope I don't digress too much. You can stop me if I do, but my main hero is Bertrand Russell.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a member of the Bertrand Russell Society. I subscribe to the journal Russell. And so here he was giving the Bertrand Russell Memorial Lecture
right. At
McMaster University, where the Russell Archives reside. And he gave this talk, and you know what? It was a standard Chomsky talk. Now, it's got, you know, there's a lot of good stuff in a standard Chomsky talk about Guatemala and East Timor and so on. But he didn't even mention Russell's name until the very last sentence. And then he said something like, well, this is the kind of thing that Bertrand Russell would want to look at. It was extremely disappointing. He had put no work into it, into actually delivering the goods at that memorial lecture. Now, I know he's busy and everything, so I can cut him some slack, but really, it's very seldom that someone gives a memorial lecture and blows it that badly. But anyway, I was there to hear the lecture, of course, and I was there to interview him for Vision TV. And I believe there were three subjects. And one had to do with faith, his faith, his religious upbringing, his faith, and what part that plays in his life. And then there was something about current affairs. I forget what was going on at the time, Haiti probably. And then the third thing was 9/11, which I saved to the last. Because in journalism, you never lead off with something that is going to be, you know, a problem for your interviewee.
Right.
And what I actually did was I created, I printed out on an 8.5 by 11 sheet, really briefly, my question to him. And I don't have it in front of me, but it was something like, which you'd be familiar with and which we've partly discussed already in this program, something like this: in light of the fact that not a single U.S. jet interceptor turned a wheel until it was too late on 9/11, and insofar as George Bush went on reading a story about a pet goat for at least 8 minutes after he was told America's under attack, and I just gave three things. Then I said, what is your view of these anomalies? This is essentially, and I put it in front of him as courtesy, you know, before the camera was rolling. And so he just took this piece of paper. It had maybe, you know, 125 words. Took this piece of paper, and as long as it takes me to tell you that, he just tossed it aside and he said, this is just conspiracy theory. It's the quote that I have in Chapter 5. And then he went on in a very energetic way. In fact, I was going to have this. I was going to have in the book about the things he said. I had a whole deconstruction of them, and finally, you know, you have stuff in a book, and it's in and it's out, and it's in and it's out.
Right.
I tell you what, this went out. Here's what he said to me. He said, "Look, you can make a conspiracy about anything." He said, "Really? Just try it. This is trademark Chomsky. Really? Just try it. You know, you can. You've heard him say that."
Yeah.
He said, "Look, you can have a car accident in a corner, and you can spin a conspiracy theory about it.
Right.
Really, just try it." Now, his wife was with him, and allegedly he was tired and pressured, and I made the very correct decision. It was no time to actually have a debate with Noam Chomsky.
Yeah.
Because Carol was saying, look, he's got to go. And he was just going at me that this is just conspiracy theory, and saying just an ordinary fender bender can be turned into conspiracy. And I just basically had to listen, thank him for his time. I said, Carol, you're right. He's got to prepare for the lecture tonight. And that was the end of the encounter. Now, when I stopped and looked at it, it was one of the most ludicrous things you can imagine. I just decided to look into a fender bender. Now, supposing that you went down to your local police station, and you wanted to look at the police blotter, and you said, look, when's the latest, you know, fender bender you had? And they say, well, it was a 3:43 this afternoon at Maple and 3rd Street.
Uh-huh.
And you looked into it. And let us suppose, okay?
Right.
Let us suppose you look into this very particular one, not a theoretical one, and when you examine it closely, it turns out that one person ran into another deliberately so the other person could collect insurance, and they had a conspiracy going between them.
Okay.
Okay, well, let's assume that.
Right.
Okay, but would that mean that every car accident can be made into a conspiracy? Of course not.
Right.
Here you have this world giant intellect dragging out an example, an analogy, a metaphor that falls flat on its face right to begin with.
Well, you can make the theory. It doesn't mean that there's any validity to the theory.
Well, no, it has to be. It has
or any
to be,
plausibility.
No, it has to be. It has to be a theory. I mean, a theory isn't just an opinion. I mean, every theory is based on a certain amount of evidence.
Oh, I see.
And what you hope is that the theory explains more of that evidence than any other theory. And then, as more evidence comes out, you change your mind, say, no, the theory I believed in doesn't cover it. This new theory covers even more of the evidence. I mean, theory and evidence are always in play with each other.
Right.
You know, theory is not opinion. Theory is a scenario that fits the evidence or the person who believes it or promotes it claims in his or her opinion that this scenario is best explained by these facts.
I see.
And these facts best fit into this scenario.
Mm-hmm.
So it's ludicrous. But here's another thing. Supposing that every car accident was a conspiracy, then would that mean that 9/11 was not? So it falls down logically there.
Right.
The thing is, so what he said to me was so incredibly, pathetically, logically flawed that it even like a 5-year-old would barely have the nerve to try to pull that off. And what I realized is that there's something wrong, deeply, deeply wrong. It's not that he's not intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that he's not well-informed. It's not that he's not passionate. But there's something that is way, way off base. And as I looked more and more into Chomsky, I became more and more alarmed and angry, actually. And that's what my 15,000-word chapter says.
Yeah, it's a really, I think it's a very very measured when it comes right down to it. You acknowledge the strengths that Chomsky does have, his valuable contributions that he's given to the anti-imperialism and human rights and justice on the planet, and then there's a disconnect for Chomsky somewhere along the way, and his evasion of the evidence and unoriginal arguments to try to back up his refusal to look at the evidence makes me start theorizing about why he would then, you know, what comes up, why doesn't he, you'd think that this would be open season for him, it would be easy pickings.
Yeah, and he has so much influence. And which is given to him. He also seeks it, but it's mainly given to him. And intellectual power, as it were, is turned over to him by people
mm-hmm.
who don't question him sufficiently. And so it's in the book. I say that he's an agent of disinformation. Now there are two phrases that are quite similar, but actually there's important distinction between them. One is disinformation agent, which implies or connotes that the individual is actually on the payroll of the CIA or such.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's an agent of disinformation, which is at a further remove from that.
Right.
And but I say he's an agent of disinformation. In other words, he might as well be on the CIA payroll because he's a redirect agent. He's a bait and switch agent. He's an agent who leads people into dead ends.
Well, what is the bait and switch? Maybe we can get into that. Explain that and how it's used in this context.
Yeah, bait and switch is an old trick. For instance, that's practiced by con men, and I would say that in a very important respect, Noam Chomsky is a con man. It has a very dark, you know, very negative connotation, but and I say in a certain respect. In a certain respect, he's a con man. What a con man does is provides to the victim things that the victim really likes, really buys into, really admires,
mm-hmm.
Really values.
Right.
Whatever it may be. You know, a con man, you know, sort of has his eye on a rich widow, and so he'll pay a lot of attention to her, and he'll take her out for dinner and wine and dine her and say lovely things about her and learn about her family and take an interest in her family and all. This is all bait. And then after a while, this guy's into her bank account. That's
right.
The switch.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see bait and switch happening in various aspects of life. Now, with Chomsky, the bait for the left, and this is the same bait that enrages the right. And then paradoxically, because the right attacks Chomsky, the left thinks, well, if the right's attacking him, then he must be good. You know, the enemy of my friend is my enemy, and the friend of my enemy is my friend. So that this polishes his stature on the left that fanatical rightists attack him so viciously and unfairly, usually. But he just tells the left what they want to hear. The left soaks it up. East Timor, Guatemala, Haiti, and the depredations of the American Empire going back to its earliest times.
Right.
And all this stuff is true. All this stuff is important. All this stuff needs to be said. And he said it very articulately for a long time and repeatedly. So that's a tremendous contribution to general public education about the overall shape of things, which only makes it all the more contradictory and really preposterous that he would fail to see some of the most toxic and pivotal practices of the very power structure that otherwise he so roundly criticizes, namely these false flag operations. I have 18 of them in my book in chapter 7.
Right.
So he refuses to think that JFK, that the state was involved whatsoever in JFK's assassination, or Robert Kennedy's, or Martin Luther King's, or Malcolm X's.
Right.
He never said anything about Paul Wellstone's plane crash. And, of course, the big litmus test is 9/11.
Yeah.
So not only does he refuse to see any government hand...
As well as the election fraud.
And election fraud, thank you. And election fraud. Mm-hmm. I mean, all this stuff is increasingly evident to millions of Americans. And this famous leftist is autistic. He's blind, but that's the rub. You see, most leftists, and I was one of them, for years and years and years, big fan of Chomsky, had 16 of his books, and I was just puzzled by these things.
Yeah.
And I ran into other leftists, I can't figure this out. I'm mystified. I'm puzzled. This is so strange. This is bizarre. How can this be? But then we all just dropped it. We're in denial because we like what he's saying. We're eating the bait.
Right.
We're eating the bait. We're in denial, just as much as a Bushite is in denial about what Bush is doing in Iraq. They always find excuses to finally endorse the war in Iraq. And you can see that finally they're so far off of the evidence that it's really quite alarming. And this is what so many on the left have been, I was one of them, for so long.
So
we cut them all this slack, we go into denial, and we just say, well, you know, it's just a mystery. Well, I don't think it's a mystery anymore. I think that this is deliberate on his part, and I cannot, you know...
Well, then what's his motivation if it's deliberate?
Well, now this is getting very difficult to deal with on air, because a person can say certain things, believe certain things in a private discussion.
Right.
But on air...
I mean, maybe in general terms, we could talk about the left. It seems to me there's a couple, I mean, that I could just sort of throw out in general, not specifically about the man Noam Chomsky, but, like, there's fear of losing credibility... fear of, you know, appearing like some kind of whacked out, crazy kook, you know, with kooky ideas. There's actual, you know, being a paid disinformation agent. Fear of losing, and rather than that, then a step below that would possibly be fear of losing funding from the foundations. I mean, those are the three big ones to me. Or else, pure denial, just like straight up psychological denial.
Well, you see, it can't be that.
Right. If it's deliberate.
Yeah, because I mean, it's deliberate. He's had loads of opportunities. Numerous people have asked him about this, public meetings and broadcasts and everything, and he's been completely consistent. But you see, he's been consistent about JFK all along.
Right.
He wrote that book, Rethinking Camelot, in 1993. Really trashed Kennedy. Didn't have to. And what is this bee he had in his bonnet, you know, about Kennedy? Kennedy was no better than any president, no better than Nixon, no different yet than any other president. Mm-hmm. And this completely disparages, anti-humanistic, disparages the power, the influence, the moral stature that particular leaders, not a great number of them, regrettably, but particular leaders have, such as Martin Luther King and JFK, in my opinion. And his brother and others. So all along, he just disparages these people in really a blood-curdling way. And his acolyte, David Barsamian, was in Toronto, I forget the year it was, speaking in the chemistry building at U of T. And it happened to be on the anniversary, very near the anniversary of JFK's assassination. It was around November the 22nd of probably 2003 or 4. And so Barsamian was asked in the question and answer period, you know, what he thought about JFK, because it's the anniversary today or yesterday or the next day. And my skin practically crawled. He said he went into this really anti-JFK diatribe, and it was complete Chomsky all down the line, that JFK was no different than any other. He was probably worse, that he wanted to kill Castro. This is true. And he brought out some things about JFK that probably were true and that are very unfortunate and proper to criticize. But then he went further, and he began to disparage people who admired JFK, even in the room. And he said, "You know what people said? People said, oh, poor JFK, he had little children. He had little children. We're supposed to feel so sorry about that." And that's the kind of tone of voice he used. It was blood-curdling. It was very, very nasty. I mean, come on. Anybody with little children who gets killed, that is a tragedy.
Yeah.
Anybody. Anybody. It's a tragedy when children are killed, and it's a tragedy when their parents are killed, like happening in Lebanon. And for anybody to talk about any human being in that way... There's something very, very deeply wrong. And David Barsamian, I heard him say that. I was there. It stuck out in my mind. And as a student of psychology, I don't think that that's completely insignificant. So of these things, for instance, Chomsky's possible fear of losing his constituency, I don't see it, because the guy is not particularly fearful.
Right.
He speaks out at great cost and at great risk, and he has done so for years. This is not a guy who's fearful. So I don't think it's got to be of some concern to any of us if we have a constituency and we may be losing it, of course. But he also has a very... He's tough-minded. And I can imagine myself, if people were to turn against me, I could handle it. I could handle it. It's happened to me before. You know, it's not the end of the world. You've got to say what you believe. And if a whole bunch of people disagree with you, well, then you keep struggling. And if you lose your seat, if you're in Congress, or if you lose your pulpit, if you're a minister, you lose your job, well, that comes with the territory. You can't be a crybaby. I've got no evidence that Noam Chomsky is a crybaby. Fear of losing funding. The guy is incredibly rich.
Right.
I didn't go into this. He has a lot of money. He doesn't have to fear of losing funding. He's 77 years old or something now. The last concern on earth that this guy has is money. And pure denial, I can't see it. So you yourself, Alan, gave those four explanations for why Chomsky. Now, that's three of the four.
Right.
The fourth one you gave is that he's a paid disinformation agent. Now, all I'll say is, let people decide.
Right. Well, you know, since we're going in that direction, and since we're talking about the money and following the money, really glad that you included this, and I kind of almost wish you would have gone more into Bob Feldman's work, because I found going to the leftgatekeepers.com and questionquestions.net to be very valuable in examining the left and left gatekeeping, and on those pages you can find a nice flow chart that you included in your book, where it shows at the top organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Skull and Bones, the CIA, and the Carlyle Group, and then the connections that those organizations have to the Schuman Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Endowment for the Arts, Soros, and the MacArthur Fund. And these then send the money down to organizations like FAIR, Miss Magazine, Alternet, the Kaplan Fund, Pacifica, Progressive Magazine, The Nation, Z Magazine, and that's really where the left is, and those those organizations are the ones that have really kept the have really framed the debate about 9/11.
Yep.
That have said, oh well, you know, George Bush is really milking this 9/11 tragedy for his own political benefit, and oh, maybe these anti-terrorist laws are draconian, and wow, we're really losing our civil liberties and supposedly in fighting these evil Arab terrorists. But that's as far as they go. They don't question the fact that these evil Arab terrorists might be a creation.
Yeah, Alan, I couldn't agree. I think you've expressed a whole lot there really well, and also I couldn't agree with you more. Well, I shouldn't say I couldn't agree with you more, but I quite agree with you in your disappointment that I did not include more about that in this chapter. I too am disappointed in that. The reality is that I only had so much time to write
right.
this book. It had to be produced on a fast track. And I'm imperfect, and I there was a lot of stuff that I had, a lot more that I had, and it. But just as that anecdote about Chomsky telling me about a fender bender, it just had to be taken out again.
Mm-hmm.
It was in, and then it was out. And the book was supposed to be 300 pages, so it ended up being 416. And then if you get too many pages, it begins to slow down the production process.
Right.
It begins to increase the cost.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not, you know, I'm not just trying to blame all this. I'm responsible for this book, every word, every comma, and I am. And there are various parts of the book that I would rather change. And if there's going to be a second edition, as opposed to a second printing, I may have a chance to correct some of this. But I don't think I'll have a chance to expand the book. I think that. And again, I'd be up against it. My God, what am I going to leave out in order to make room for other stuff
right.
that should be in?
Yeah.
And it's just, you probably know as a radio producer that there are these decisions, and it's very seldom that we do the perfect radio program, the perfect book, the perfect newspaper article. But I really agree with your point, and I would encourage people to build themselves on to explore, as you have done and as you do. When I just touch on a theme all too lightly, I would encourage people to follow through. Now, one thing, there's another criticism that can be leveled at this book, is that there's no resource section. And
right.
That was partly deliberate and partly just ran out of time. I thought of putting in, you know, various websites. And but then I thought, well, my gosh, you know, there's so many websites, and there are incredible new ones come up. And
right.
if you go to one good one, like 911truth.org, it really leads you to so many others, and people discover websites on their own. And I thought, you know, why should I give a certain small number of websites and
exactly.
recommend them, and it would become out of date, and other people would be left out?
Right.
Anyway,
reading
here, giving you insight into the mind of the author here.
Well, and you know, on the back page, you know, there's like a one-fifth of the page is about the author, and the rest of the page is about Global Outlook.
Yeah.
Which, you know, and I like maybe bought one thing from the Global Outlook catalog before I even read, you know, I never ordered the magazine, never subscribed to the magazine. I started getting all these copies of the magazine. They kept sending me free magazines. So it's just like, hey, this is cool. I could just buy a thing or two off the catalog and get, you know, I think that's wise. All you have to do is type whatever 9/11 truth into the Google, and boy, you're inundated with information.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. But I'm not saying I'm right, but I'm just explaining. I'm not defending, I'm explaining.
One of the most important things I think that this book does is, you know, it brings in the media, you know, focuses on the media, but then it also highlights a very important phrase that I think everyone needs to get familiar with. That's false flag operations.
Yep.
And you devote an entire chapter of false flag operations happening from the 1600s with the gunpowder plot all the way up to what I think is the most censored news story of 2005, the Basra police SAS agents, that I thought was so huge to show that the, quote, insurgency in Iraq, and the reason why we can't, quote, leave Iraq or cut and run Iraq is because a lot of this insurgency is false flag operations to create civil war and a three-party state in Iraq.
Yeah.
But and while I'm just sort of introducing this chapter and I want to talk to you about it, I just thought I'd just bring in my critique of it. You said there's, what, 18 points?
I think there's 18 cases all told in the chapter, yeah.
And I would have taken out maybe, I don't know, one of those and replace Oklahoma City with the other one with that because it was very extremely high profile. The evidence is very large to suggest as it being a false flag operation, and it directly ties in to your thesis about left gatekeeping. And because my theory is that Democrats don't want to look at 9/11 truth because it will challenge both the right and their left party. Their entire Democratic Party will be called into question if 9/11 truth is real. Then all of a sudden we have to question every large-scale terror act. And if we start questioning Oklahoma City, then all of a sudden Clinton's halo falls off, and he becomes complicit, obviously, in Oklahoma City. So that's my.
You know what, Alan? As soon as you said that, I instantly recognized that you were hitting a nail right on the head. It's absolutely true. Looking back on it, my only excuse there would be, and it's an excuse now, I think. Because I know about Oklahoma City, of course, I was at the 9/11, the D.C. 9/11 truth, the D.C. Truth Convergence in Washington, D.C. in July of 2005, and Oklahoma City was big. I learned a whole lot about it there. I'd known a little bit about it before, and I asked a researcher, a good friend of mine, he's thanked in the beginning there, Terry Burrows. If he would drop a list of false flag operations going back to Sparta, and wow. Of course I had a list. I put all the things on the list I could think of. He drew up a list. We asked around. We ended up with a really long list.
Right.
and we had to narrow it down somehow by trying to decide how many centuries would we cover and which. Countries would we cover and different kinds of incidents. We had to define, of course, false flag operations.
Right, and maybe we haven't done that yet in this show, and maybe we should briefly.
Yeah, well, yeah. But having said all that,
right.
Alan, having said all that, you are absolutely right. We missed Oklahoma City. End of story.
Yeah.
It should be there.
Yeah.
And I thank you for that. And if I have it, now I'm talking now, if there's going to be a second edition of the book as opposed to a second printing, in a second printing, you can fix, you know, you can correct things, little
typos.
Relatively small errors
mm-hmm.
and omissions.
Mm-hmm.
But in a second printing, you can do more.
Right.
And I would drop one of them, I don't know which one, and put in Oklahoma City. I also noticed David Ray Griffin has a new book out. I just got it yesterday. It's somewhere
The Christian
in my desk.
Response or something.
It's a Christian's response.
Something like that, right?
Yeah, Christian's response to 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
I started to read it. He, of course, very early in the book, he refers to false flag operations, explains what they are, and gives some examples. And he gave an example that never came up to, that we didn't discover in our research, mm-hmm. which is called the Muck Den, M-U-K-D-E-N, the Muck Den incident.
Huh.
And this was one. This was one that was done by the Japanese, in which they were in Manchuria. They claimed that some Manchurians had fired a machine gun at their train or something. And of course, the whole Japanese public is all up in arms, and they used that as the pretext for a full-fledged invasion of the Chinese mainland in Manchuria, and which in turn went a long way towards setting up the bad situation that the result of which was the Second World War. So these false flag operations aren't just, you know, interesting historical incidents. These are things that change the lives of millions,
yeah.
and for the worse. And I can't too strongly preach, if you will, that we've got to get wise to the fact these are done all the time. The latest example, by the way, is this, to me, actually hilarious transatlantic shampoo bomb false terror fraud.
Yeah.
I mean, that is so obviously a cockamamie thing cooked up by MI5, full collusion between the Anglo-American spooks, and it just doesn't add up at all. And it has all the hallmarks of being a hoax.
Yeah. Well, and it seems so low payoff for the effort. I mean, what are you getting out of it? I mean, really, it's like it's not really like whipping anybody up. It's just pissing people off, I think.
Well, as a matter of fact, it's died out. It didn't have that great legs. And you have even mainstream columnists like Gwyn Dyer actually coming up with full-scale column. He syndicated, and he said this was a fraud.
Wow.
Right out.
Wow.
In print. And a lot of people have suspicions. But here's the thing. If you you just have to look at the front page of the New York Times to find out why a lot of things are done. I don't mean you believe necessarily what's in the New York Times, but there's a lot of the New York Times that that is indicative, like it's signage. And you notice that the day before Lieberman was defeated,
mm-hmm.
Cheney, and they called it unusual, but he called a telephone press conference, Cheney did, and he said, if Lieberman loses, it's going to encourage the Al-Qaeda types.
Yeah,
remember?
Right. Yeah.
Now, he obviously had advance warning about this, the transatlantic shampoo fraud.
Sure.
And he was trying to get people to vote differently. That was the point. And then the day later, he would be proven to be an extremely wise and perspicacious person because
right.
he said that. Now, the New York Times, I believe this morning or very recently, I get it every day, said that that Lieberman himself is attacking Ned Lamont on the basis that he's soft on this new terror thing that happened.
The shampoo terror thing?
Yep. He has made this one of the earliest, I'm looking for
campaign talking points?
Yep.
Wow.
Front page of New York Times.
What's to say about it? I mean, there's nothing to say about this. I mean,
I agree with you. But
I think that no candidate should be supported unless he's out front about 9/11 truth, but that's just me.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you there. And it's bugging me that I can't find the front page of the Times here that I ripped out. This is really bugging me. But I assure you, you'll see it on the front page. It might have been not today. It might have been yesterday. And that Lieberman was just jumping on that terror plot and just using it as a club against Lamont right out of the starting gate. So they use this. These are planned as political events to continue the drumbeat of fear in the general public, to continue to try to build the popularity of the leaders Blair and Bush and the like, who have only the one card to play now. It's only terrorism, the so-called war on terror, on which any significant number of people rate Bush highly, and same with Blair. And so there. And as I say in the in my chapter on false flag operations, I quote a CIA hand who says, "When you only have one act you can do, you keep on doing it."
Yeah.
CIA veteran John Sherwood, and this is the only card they have to play now, is these fake operations.
Yeah,
and they're doing them, and they're just doing one after another, and it just enrages me that the media constantly just accept them right out of the starting gate as completely authentic, and they have just hundreds of hours of airtime, all solemn, looking into all the different angles and aspects of it, and
yeah.
the whole thing is a crock. You can see it from the first.
Yeah.
And what really ticked me off about this latest one is then they have a series of stories that subsequently and alleged evidence and so on that are subsequently released and dribbled out in the days following. And this helps to keep the story alive.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ones I don't know if you saw it, was played on the front page of the Toronto Star, is that one of these fanatical Muslim couples were willing to use their own infant baby as a bomb.
Oh, wow.
That they actually, yeah, that the formula was going to be an explosive, and that they were willing to have that baby blown up to serve their evil, diabolical aims. And when, and that is just, you know, that is so tearing it so far, that is so dehumanizing by extension of all Muslims and so forth. But also, it's so incredible. I mean, it's
right.
really incredible. It, and they have to pull out these highly emotional things. By the way, when you hear babies, in the First World, the British have always been experts at this kind of propaganda. They've always been leaders in false flag operations and the like. You'll notice the very first one in the chapter is the gunpowder plot in England.
Right.
But in the First World War, the British put out the propaganda that German soldiers were bayoneting babies. They were actually impaling babies on the ends of their bayonets and then tossing them in the air and laughing. And that was proven not to be true. I mean, you know, even Germans aren't that bad. And then in the run-up to Desert Storm, there was the infamous story that the Iraqi soldiers had come into a Kuwaiti hospital and yanked the oxygen tubes from these incubator babies, threw the babies on the cold floor to die.
Yeah.
When you hear somebody is killing babies, you better your antenna better
yeah.
tell you to look into this.
Yeah.
This is in all likelihood a false flag operation.
Yeah.
You know, when it's a stunning individual incident. I don't mean babies aren't dying in Lebanon, for instance.
Right.
But that's mass state terror. But when it's just an alleged individual, so that's one of the telltale signs of a false flag operation.
The allegedness of it and the emotional sauciness
yeah,
to it.
That's it. It's to try to get people
mm-hmm. to have that reaction
by their emotional short hairs
mm-hmm.
and just scandalize them
and demand them for the powers that be to go in there and do something. Because
well,
that's what they want to do is whatever it is that they're trying to spin. Oh, we need to go in there and bomb those dirty guys, you know.
Well, exactly. And there's a word for it that I haven't used yet. That's demonization.
Yeah.
So people who will use their baby as a bomb, they're demons.
Right.
So you're demonizing them.
And just quickly, I just wanted to say how frustrating it is when I don't recall you even putting a chapter in or a paragraph would have worked of Ward Churchill's analysis. Maybe you did that to say that the 19 Arabs didn't do this is racist, and because that's saying that Arabs are incapable of doing this complex thing, which is just ridiculous. But he spins this sort of race baiting story, and that yet I feel like 9/11 truth people are the ones who are trying to defend the Muslim faith and Arabs around the world, and it's just like, how dare you? And what, why you're sort of calling us racist when we're trying to defend Islam and the Arab race? I mean, it's just like, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's just like, ugh, so
well,
annoying.
It actually could make sense. And I tell you, I could have included Ward Churchill in the book.
Yeah.
And I thought of doing so. And I decided against it because things get so so confused when it comes to Ward Churchill.
Yeah.
I don't think he's a straight-ahead person.
No, I don't think so either.
After the book's come out after the book was written, then he's been fired, I think.
Mm.
So the situation is moving with him, but I can't. I have so many problems with Ward Churchill that I thought, you know, I don't need to have
right.
him in the book.
No.
That still could be considered a shortcoming. I mean, I don't reject your disappointment. I don't demean it.
I noticed it wasn't there, and it could have. It would have, I think, supported some of your other arguments about left gatekeeping. But
yeah, it would have. and maybe that was just simply an error in judgment. It was a judgment,
right,
which I thought probably on balance was the correct one, but maybe I'm wrong on that, and quite possibly I'm wrong on that.
And finally, I want to let you go here pretty quick, but I did want to just sort of just thank you for the at the very end, about at the very last chapter where you talk about you really focus on empowering others and using the media, and I'd like you just to hear your take on when you look forward, how optimistic you are, what tactics you see as being effective. Sometimes it seems to me like everyone's pretty much made up their mind, and maybe I'm arguing with your statement earlier that people, you know, just are ignorant. But sometimes it seems like, well, hasn't everyone pretty much heard the arguments for and against the two competing conspiracy theories that are out there that made it happen on purpose, and 19 Arabs? Those are the two big ones, and everything else is kind of shades of those two. You know, how are we going to win, and what's what? How do you see it come in the future?
Well, in a way, I would agree with something that Chomsky perennially says when he is inevitably, as he always is, asked, what can we do?
Mm-hmm.
And what he says is, keep doing what you're doing. And actually, I agree with him on that. But I think that we need to go beyond that.
Yeah.
And we have to say that the worst enemy of anything that you're doing that is along the lines of working for world peace, working to save the ecosystem of the planet, working for social justice, working for better health care for Americans and for other people around the world, working to save the agricultural system, to prepare for the end of oil, all these worthy projects and causes, all of which I support as much as you know, as anybody can, all these are threatened by this oligarchy,
yeah,
this hyper-militaristic, greed-obsessed, planet-killing oligarchy. So that the question is, how can you undermine, how can you degrade, how can you eventually replace this, mm-hmm, oligarchy? You can't do it with arms, because,
yeah,
they're so armed, you're
right,
dead.
Right.
So you have to work at, in my opinion, intelligently, you work at their weakest point.
Yeah.
That's what you would do. And their weakest point, the biggest Achilles heel in world history, is the brazenness of their 9/11 false flag operation.
Yeah.
And that is the way, if we can get enough people, a politically significant fraction of the American people who see that and begin to take action and demand that that the perpetrators, that there be one or more major new investigations, true investigations,
yeah,
done fairly, into 9/11, the evidence is going to come out, and that's when the general public can see that these people are treasonous. There's no other word, treasonous, and they,
yep,
can be brought up on treason charges. And then you could begin, it would be a very dangerous period, because, of course, some people stop at when they think of that, and they say, oh, my God, well, they'll declare martial law,
right,
and then they'll throw me in jail. And that is a very real possibility. But what are we going to do? Sit and let it get worse and worse, and we'd be thrown into jail anyway?
Yeah.
Are we going to be like the Jews that just walked and went and got onto those trains and went to their deaths? No. I would rather die fighting than to let the oligarchs stay in power and become more and more powerful, more and more dangerous. So go after their Achilles heel, I say, and that's 9/11. That's why, in my opinion, 9/11, it's the most important single issue that we face, and that every good cause that you can name is hurt for every day that we fail to reveal 9/11, which in turn is the Achilles heel of this planet-destroying oligarchy. And so, like Chomsky, I say, keep doing what you're doing, but focus on 9/11.
Right.
And keep helping the environment and working on peak oil and so on. And that's what I've chosen to do anyway. And if I can help other people to see it the same way, I don't think I'm in doing any harm. I think I'm actually helping
yeah,
our planet. You can't go wrong to champion 9/11 truth, because you can't go wrong a champion truth to begin with.
Yeah.
But it's not just a champion, any old truth. It's the most important truth in our world today.
Yeah.
It's the linchpin for the so-called war on terrorism, which is the excuse for everything else, for Afghanistan, Iraq, resource theft, diminution of civil liberties, building of detention centers, all the rest. They always say, remember 9/11
yeah.
when innocent Americans were attacked by these horrible, fanatical Arabs. And the whole thing is a demonic delusion.
Yeah.
And David Ray Griffin, in his new book about a Christian's approach to 9/11, does say that the American government, and he's a theologian, has
yeah.
become demonic.
Yeah.
And
wow.
he gives evidence to back up that word that is not out of place.
Hmm.
And it's a gargantuan struggle we're in on the earth today. I really truly feel there's a turning point. I started to read David Corton's new book called The Great Turning.
Oh, uh-huh.
I'll be reading that on my tour, From Empire to Earth Community. And there's millions of people who see this one way or another and want to do it, but we've got to do it. I'm taking my life savings to do this. I'm
yeah.
spending all my energy possible. My wife gets after me. She says I don't pay enough attention to the family, and she's right.
Yeah.
But I don't feel that I don't feel I'm a saint or a hero. I just feel I have to do it.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of other people who feel that way too.
Mm-hmm.
And we should encourage other people to get as involved as they can, and to see that their children and their grandchildren are in great danger. The planet's in danger, and with the United States, again, referring to David Ray Griffin's new book, that, and this is a statistic, comes from an economist who's quite dependable, that in fact, if you look at the whole of U.S. Government expenditures, 68 cents out of every American tax dollar is going for militarism.
Wow.
68 of 100.
What a waste.
That is demonic.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no need. America is not under that much danger.
Yeah.
And it's in fact, it's in no danger at all.
Yeah, no, except from us.
Pardon?
Well, it depends on what you call America, but yeah. Barry Zwicker, thanks for coming on to my show. I really appreciate it. This is a great book. It's available on the internet. I guess newsociety.com is the publisher.
Yeah, newsociety.com is the publisher. You can buy it there. I understand Amazon has it for sale.
Great.
And I do also want to say in the dying minutes here that I'm also selling it myself. And when I sell it, I offer a good price, which is just $21.
Okay.
And plus shipping and handling. And then I get a larger percentage of the revenue from that book when I sell it myself. I've purchased 500 copies initially from the publisher.
And, what's the phone number or contact for that?
Yeah, the phone number is the very one that you phoned me that we're on now. It's 416 area code, 416, and the number is 651-5588. 416-651-5588. And there's you press 2 for the order line, and I'm leaving on my tour, and my assistant Karen will clear that line every day and fulfill your orders.
And it comes with a DVD.
Shipping and handling. And three books for $55.
Wow, that's a deal. That's a deal. All right. Thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Alan, I really appreciated meeting you from the beginning. I'm really glad you invited me on your show, and we changed. You allowed me to change the date to when the book should be in bookstores.
Yep.
I've really enjoyed it, and I hope we might do it again sometime.
Oh, I think we will.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Well, there you go. Fine gentleman, Barry Zwicker. All right. So I'm just going to call it a show. I'm just going to play this one song, go out with Presage with the song called Media.
The media, the media, the media. How many of you really believe that the media tells you the truth? The media, the media, the media, the media. How many of you really believe that the media tells you the truth?
They lie.
for us. transformed the United States into an enslaved unit of the United Nations One World Government.
This is a song that warns you in advance that next year everybody is going to try and sell you things that maybe you shouldn't ought to buy. And not only that, they've been planning it for years. They've been planning it for years. They've been planning it for years. They've been planning it for years.
Don't know how you came by this record, but you are now embarked upon a journey that must certainly lead you to change your life forever. If you were never a special person, you are a special person now. Hello, Seeker. Now don't feel alone here in the New Age, because there's a Seeker born every minute.